Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn raised hopes amongst millions of people that after many long years of politics seeming to shift further and further to the right, progressive change, it seemed, was again possible. But we have to say that their hopes were cruelly dashed. Sanders' challenge to the Democratic Party establishment in the US was crushed, and Corbyn was subject to a vicious campaign that destroyed his leadership of the British Labor Party. Unfortunately, none of this, I think, should come as any great shock to socialists. Workers and the oppressed are constantly told that to achieve a change, that they should rely on the official structures of capitalist society, above all, Parliament. It is a lie. All the supposed democratic institutions of capitalism are structured in such a way as at every step to frustrate genuinely radical change. There is no electoral or parliamentary road to socialism. Openly, pro-capitalist bourgeois parties like the Democrats in the US can never be transformed to serve working class interests, and neither can social democratic parties like the Australian or the British Labor Party. Workers can only achieve meaningful change by mass struggle, by using their own collective organised power. And to be successful in the ultimate sense, those struggles need to go forward to the ultimate conclusion. But to achieve that, there needs to be a revolutionary party built that's committed to taking them forward to victory and that's prepared, you know, to go all the way and not to compromise. Okay, to start first with Bernie Sanders. The US Democrats are one of the oldest, if not the oldest, capitalist parties in the world. For 200 years nearly, they have vigorously advanced the interests of the rich and powerful, from defending slavery, waging imperialist wars, crushing working class struggles, and leading, you know, vicious witch hunts against the left. It is often said that the Republicans in the US are the A-team for US capitalism, and the Democrats are the B-team. However, in the last few presidential elections, the Democrats received more corporate funding than the Republicans. And this was even much more noticeably a case at the recent elections when Biden was backed by a clear majority of the bourgeoisie against Trump. Biden was seen as being much more capable of defending the imperialist interests of the US state against China than was the erratic Trump, who had alienated a series of the US's key allies in Europe. The Democrats were also seen as being better placed to stabilise US politics and to co-opt dissent, in particular to co-opt dissent by the black population, you know, was reflected in the Black Lives Matter protests, because they were seen to be able to do this because they had a more liberal image and because they had strong ties to the black elite, to the black establishment. The Democrats have long been a broad church party with a minority small L liberal wing, which at times has included social democrats like Sanders. This minority liberal wing is very useful for the Democrats in their attempts to portray themselves as being, to voters, as being more progressive than the Republicans. Sanders is but one of a long line of small-L liberal progressive challengers to the party leadership that, if you go back decades, included Eugene McCarthy, George McGovern, and the black activist Jesse Jackson. The difference this time around the Democrats was that there had not been a serious progressive liberal challenger for the presidential nomination for some decades. That's the first difference. Second difference was that, unlike previous liberal challengers, Sanders proclaimed that he was a socialist. The third difference was that Sanders found a mass resonance for his ideas amongst workers and young people utterly fed up with decades of attacks on their living standards and on their rights. Sanders helped popularise the idea of socialism, and that was an important step forward, though he popularised it in a pretty vague and not clearly defined way. However, Unlike what many of the cheerleaders for Jacobin on the US left, the cheerleaders for Sanders, such as Jacobin on the US left, and the leadership of the Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA, which is now the largest socialist organisation in the US, unlike what they claimed, Sanders has remained and was throughout thoroughly loyal to the Democratic Party. He never intended to break from the Democrats, and he never intended to undermine the Democrats. So, despite the vicious campaign by the Democratic establishment that frustrated and defeated his two bids for presidential nomination, Sanders, after he was defeated, then went on to first to support the odious Hillary Clinton to be president, and then strongly campaigned for the long-term capitalist establishment hack, Joe Biden. Despite his claims to be a socialist, Sanders simply strove to build a liberal faction in the Democrats, not to lay the basis for a working-class party, not even for a working-class party of the pathetic, tepid sort that we see in the Australian and British Labor parties. And now Sanders has been rewarded for his loyalties to the Democrats with the position of the head of the very powerful and central budget committee of the Senate, in which now he plays a key role in forcing through Biden's political agenda. The campaign in support of Sanders by the DSA and numerous other socialists in the US served to draw them further and further into the Democratic Party and led them to focus overwhelmingly on electoral politics rather than on mass struggle. So, for example, while the DSA leadership threw its support into the electoral campaign for Sanders and for other Democrats, for that matter, it did actually virtually nothing to mobilise its members to support and to intervene in the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, a movement that involved up to 20 to 25 million people on the streets of the US, the largest mass movement for decades in the US. And it should be noted that Sanders himself was extremely careful at the time of the Black Lives Matter to not to be identified in any way at all with street militancy. The DSA endorsed a formal policy which was called Bernie or Bust, i.e. that supposedly Sanders was an exception to other Democrats, that he was totally different and that was allowable to support him, but that they would not supposedly campaign for any other Democrat for president. He was supposedly qualitatively different to Biden. But in reality, they were on a slippery slope. Having campaigned for one candidate of a capitalist party, a capitalist establishment party, it was not then a great further step to campaign for another one, the hack, Joe Biden. And that is precisely what happened in practice. The DSA refused to stand against the weight of left-dieselism, which has so long dominated US policies, and fell into line behind supposedly lesser evil Biden, who would be stand up, you know, vigorously to China, you know, really defending working class interests, and was the candidate of the capitalist establishment. The DSA's capitulation to the Democrat, however, went much further than simply backing Joe Biden against Trump. In the Senate races that occurred in the reruns in Georgia after the presidential election, the DSA gave a green light to its members in Atlanta and other cities in Georgia to campaign for quite right-wing conservative Democratic parties, party candidates. And this has become an increasing pattern. The DSA claims to be building an alternative, a working-class alternative to the Democrats. But you don't build a working-class party by campaigning for Democrats. All you do is help to reinforce illusions in the Democrats and draw your own activists deeper and deeper into this utterly reactionary party. This remains an ongoing problem for the left in the US, so much of which is obsessed with electoralism and refuses to make a clean break for Democrats. The pattern of leftist cheerleading for the Democrats is not simply, of course, reflected around Sanders, but in the lack of any critical stand towards outright opportunists like AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who and the squad, who are now little more than a cheer squad for Biden. There needs to be a sharp break with the dead end of electoralism and with the Democrats. If a socialist left is to be built in the US, that can play a role in leading workers' struggles forward to victory and leading the struggles of the oppressed forward to victory. Okay, the shift on from Sanders to Corbyn. Now, the election of Jeremy Corbyn in September 2015 as the leader of the British Labour Party came as a devastating shock to the British Labour establishment, long dominated by hard right-wing Blairite forces. In reality, it was a tiny number of MPs that actually voted for Corbyn. The great majority of British Labour MPs viewed Corbyn as an embarrassing left-wing crank, a throwback to a bygone era which they'd hoped had been buried. And this was not simply the opinion of the Blairite right-wing, but also of the sort of Guardian-type soft left, the so-called moderates in the party, the establishment left, if you like. Corbyn was also detested by the Labour Party's party apparatus, which sabotaged him at every turn. On the other hand, who backed Corbyn? Well, he was backed by the great majority of rank-and-file members of the party and supporters of the party who were fed up with how right-wing Labour had become. The other key backers of Corbyn were powerful sections of the trade union bureaucracy in Britain. Now, Corbyn's own politics, has to be said, were well to the left of Bernie Sanders. He had long been a principal opponent of the Labour Party leadership in Britain. Unlike Sanders, he had repeatedly in Parliament voted against the Labour Party line in defence of left-wing policies. He was an active supporter of numerous left-wing movements on the streets, including movements against racism, the mass movements against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he was upfront supporter of the Palestinian struggle. In other words, he was a committed left reformist. Indeed, I would argue his ideological worldview was well to the left of most of the people that actually voted him in to be leader. Nonetheless, it has to be said that the anti-austerity programs that Corbyn ran on in the 2017 and 2019 British general elections, while they did contain very important reforms for working class people, were in no sense an anti-capitalist, let alone a socialist program. Corbyn's program seemed radical, however, to people because the Labour programs of the last couple of decades had been so abysmally right-wing. The reality was that if you look back in a longer view, you see that Corbyn's programs in 2017 and 2019 were nowhere as left-wing as the programs that 30 or 40 years ago the right-wing of the Labour Party used to support. The right-wing of the Labour Party used to support massive taxes on the rich, 90% rate of taxation on the rich, massive confiscatory attacks on big business, the nationalisation of big interests. You know, I mean, I was a kid. Healey, who was the leader of the right in the Labour Party, the treasurer, a candidate in the Labour Party, said, "We're going to squeeze the rich until the pips squeal." That was the right wing of the Labour Party. Indeed, Corbyn's program was even to the right of the program that Gough Whitlam was elected on here in Australia. And we've got to remember that Whitlam, despite the romanticisation of a lot of people of it, was a creature of the hard right of the Labour Party here, which intervened here in Victoria to crush the left of the party. That's one problem. The other key weakness of Corbyn's political approach was that he remained thoroughly loyal to Labour and was not prepared to break with it, no matter how appallingly right-wing was its orientation and how badly it actually treated him as an individual. He was committed to Labour as a broad church party. In other words, He believed there was a space for right-wingers in the party. And that space wasn't the rubbish bin. He was never prepared to go for the jugular against the right. In the way that the right and the centre-left was ruthlessly prepared to go for the jugular against him and the hard left of the party. Corbyn continually strove for unity with the right and the centre-left of the party. And that meant compromise after compromise. But the compromises, of course, never satisfied his opponents. They just were emboldened by them and continued the campaign to undermine him. So while Corbyn was not prepared to lead a decisive fight against the right and the centre-left have systematically purged principled left-wingers from the Labor Party. Indeed, Corbyn's leadership group voted down moves to deselect right-wing MPs, loving Labor MPs, even though there was widespread support amongst branch members to get rid of them. And while I've emphasised the role of the right in attacking Corbyn, it has to be vigorously underlined in many ways that some of his most vicious opponents were pseudo left-wingers, the sort of soft left people championed by the Guardian newspaper in Britain and Australia, for that matter, who led some of the most vile attacks on Corbyn. The other factor that made Corbyn's position weaker were the serious political weaknesses of his key supporters. Corbyn could not have won the leadership of the Labor Party without the backing of influential trade union leaders such as Len McCuskey of the Unite Union. These union leaders voted for Corbyn not because they agreed with him, but because they were pissed off by the way they'd been isolated and humiliated by the establishment of the Labor Party and that by the old leadership. However, the bulk of these union leaders were in no sense principled left-wingers. They definitely were not in any sense socialists or anti-capitalists. They ran their unions as top-down bureaucratic empires and repeatedly betrayed the interests of their working-class members. They had absolutely no fighting spirit when it came to taking on the bosses. And they had long presided over historically low levels of strike action. The union bureaucrats used their support for Corbyn as a way to deflect criticism by rank-and-file militants in their unions for their do-nothing industrial approach. McCluskey and the other union officials repeatedly acted as constraining influences on Corbyn, opposing left-wing policies such as opposition to Britain's vast array of nuclear weapons and in particular to the newly being established Trident missile program. The union bureaucrats also essentially vetoed any rank-and-file move to unseat notorious right-wing Labor MPs. Because the reality is they did not want the Labor Party to become dominated by the left. And eventually, of course, they deserted Corbyn, refusing to defend him against the vile slanders that he was anti-Semitic because he supported the rights of the Palestinians. The union leaders, in turn, by and large, have now fallen in behind the new right-wing Labor leader, Keir Starmer, and have not in any way stood up to try to prevent the mass purge that is taking place of left-wingers from the party. In the elections when Corbyn was first elected leader and then in the second rerun, he also obtained the votes of the mass of Labor's rank-and-file members, large numbers of whom had joined the party recently precisely to vote for him. Now, some of these were older former members who had dropped out disillusioned by how, because of, Labor had become so right-wing. Now they rejoined. Many others were leftward-moving younger people, inspired by the breath of fresh air that Corbyn seemed to offer. Now, at the time, a number of leftists in Britain, and internationally for that matter, argued that Marxists in Britain should now join the Labor Party to push it further to the left and try to turn it into an outright socialist party. In my view, such an approach would have been a very serious mistake for socialists to make. As has now been very clearly demonstrated, that there's no way that an entrenched, long-standing, bureaucratic, reformist party like the Labor Party was going to be transformed into a genuinely socialist party. Labor's movers and shakers, the union officials, the MPs, the party apparatus, and in many ways, above all, their ruling class backers, were never going to allow that to happen. Moreover, while many new members who joined Labor to support Corbyn were moving to the left to some extent, I think it would be a mistake to exaggerate how solidly committed they were to left-wing politics, let alone socialist politics. In practice, we've seen in the most recent union, leadership election, a whole chunk of these people who had previously voted for Corbyn as leader now voted for the arch-right-winger Keir Starmer as leader, which hardly points to that they were super radical to start with. Their low level of radicalisation and political understanding reflected the fact there was not a broader upsurge of working-class struggle taking place in Britain in the lead-up to Corbyn coming leader or during the Corbyn years. The union movement remained on the defensive and there were very few strikes. Mass protests on the streets had also markedly receded. And indeed, for many, I would argue, supporting Corbyn in the Labor Party became a substitute for mass struggle. And it has to be said that Corbyn and his key supporters did next to nothing to try to turn this situation around. They made no serious effort to mobilise their tens of thousands of supporters, maybe 100,000 of supporters, to mobilise them into struggle. Winning votes in parliamentary elections was their overwhelming focus. Next to no effort was made to politically educate and radicalise the new Corbyn supporters. They were just relied upon to be canvassing fodder in elections. And Corbyn himself retreated further and further from what had been his own persona a decade earlier of engagement in, you know, politics on the streets, you know, extra-parliamentary activity. There was no focus at all on mass mobilisation outside the terrain of elections. And that's very important, because in reality, there's only by involvement in mass struggle that there is any possibility of broad layers of people, of masses of people, of those young Corbyn supporters being further radicalised and toughened up and hardened politically. It's only in such struggles that they could potentially have learned how to fight the whole array of pro-capitalist forces, in the Labor Party, the trade unions, and so on, and become battle-hardened. Moreover, in mass struggle, they would have been exposed to the treacherous role of the trade union leaders and of the soft left, and have potentially then been able to draw conclusions that you needed to break sharply with them if you have any chance of seriously challenging capitalism. But instead, the Corbyn supporters group momentum quickly moved away from being anything approaching a genuinely extra-parliamentary campaigning organisation. It was rapidly bureaucratised and purged of radicals. Its head, John Landsman, eventually even turned on Corbyn and joined in backing the spurious allegations of entrenched anti-Semitism amongst the Labor left. Corbyn himself gradually moved further to the right, notably in the aftermath of the 2017 general elections. He made repeated attempts to appease so-called moderate MPs. And Corbyn also sought to placate big business. One of Corbyn's core supporters, John McDonnell, the shadow chancellor, which is equivalent to being the shadow treasurer here. McDonnell had been, he created his image in politics early on as this fiery boss hater. You know, you couldn't find a person that denounced bosses more severely and championed the Irish Republican Army. But now After talking to his local parish priest, he spent his time courting the bankers of the City of London and other top bosses and sought to moderate his image. And despite all Corbyn's concessions, the party machine and the bulk of MPs were determined to destroy him. They preferred to lose the 2019 elections than have Corbyn elected Prime Minister. The reality is that even if Corbyn had won in 2019, the majority of Labor MPs would have lined up with the public service bureaucracy, with the media, with big business to frustrate and sabotage any genuinely radical reforms that Corbyn attempted to introduce. And now, under Keir Starmer's leadership, the Labor establishment are carrying out a thorough purge of the party of anyone who's seen to be a left-wing troublemaker. And the Corbynite left, because of its reformist politics and loyalty to the Labor Party, has been totally unable to offer any serious resistance to this purge. Keir Starmer is determined to wipe out the possibility that someone like Corbyn could ever again become a Labor leader. And the fact that Starmer focuses his energy overwhelmingly on attacking the left and virtually hardly ever attacks the Tory government is simply not some personal quirk. It reflects the fact that the Labor establishment is out to prove its loyalty to the British ruling class, to demonstrate that if Labor wins office, it could be relied upon to run the British imperialist state on behalf of the City of London and the broader capitalist class, and that Labor will go all out to crush any left-wing dissent or any serious threat by the working class. Okay, so one to one up. Now, it is completely understandable that masses of people look to elections and Parliament to achieve change, especially in a context where the level of working class struggle remains low, and in countries like the US and Britain, that is particularly the case. Workers are prone to look to saviours from on high to rescue them when they have little confidence in their own collective action to take charge of the society and reorder it in their own image to serve their class interests. That's one thing to say about massive working class people. However, it is an entirely different matter for those on the left who proclaim that they are socialists or even Marxists to sow illusions in the possibility of fundamental change for the working class occurring through supporting bourgeois parties like the Democrats or social democratic parties like the Labor Party in parliamentary elections. Tragically, too many people on the left who should have known a lot better simply fell in line uncritically behind Sanders and Corbyn in search of a get-rich-quick scheme for social change. It was a dead-end approach that utterly predictably ended in disaster in Britain with the absolute rout of the Corbynite left, which has meekly collapsed in the face of the assault by the soft left and the right. In the US case, it led to a marked shift to the right by the leadership of the Democratic Socialists of America as it incorporated itself deeper and deeper into the Democrats. As well, the other casualty in the US was that a whole series of former revolutionaries were now co-opted into essentially reformist politics. Where socialists have sufficient forces, they should undoubtedly run in parliamentary elections openly as socialists against all capitalist parties in order to draw a clear class line in elections. However, the notion that fundamental change can come through bourgeois elections is but an eternal mirage. There are no shortcuts when it comes to challenging capitalism. Capitalism is only going to be seriously challenged by mass struggles, mass strikes, workplace occupations, Milton Street protests, and uprising, the like of which you're seeing in Myanmar at the moment. Building revolutionary organisations that can lead these struggles forward to victory and offer an alternative to the inevitable attempts by the reformist forces and smaller liberal forces to derail them needs to be our key task, not cheerleading for reformists. Now, let me.